The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
That too, you see, how you interpret that will be affected also by whether or not you take the next clause, the Erchomenon Eistan Kosmon, as modifying man or as modifying the light. If you take the passages later in the Gospel, you know, like when Jesus says, I'll draw men to myself. Now, there's more than one way of understanding that, but even from a Reformed perspective, you know, there have been attempts to read that in a truly universal sense. There is some sense in which Jesus draws all men to himself without that statement being necessarily some soteriological effect upon these individuals. So I guess I would probably want to argue that however you take that passage later in chapter 12, probably this should be taken in a comparable way. But as I say, I mean, just reading it, you would have no reason to take it in any sense other than each and every individual. Other questions? The last detail, if you can call it that, that I want to talk about is verse 1. And the problem with that clause, theos ein halagos, theos ein halagos. As you know, particularly among Jehovah's Witnesses, it is standard to point to the lack of the article there, kai theos, instead of kai ha theos, and to say, well, that anarthrous position or anarthrous form indicates the idea of divine, not that Jesus is God, but that he is, the word is divine. And once you say that, you know, you have a whole range of things. You know, this chocolate is divine, and so on. Now, the argument, you know, does have a small measure of truth, because, as you know, it is standard to, in the grammars, to point out that sometimes the anarthrous form sort of calls attention to the character of what you're talking about. And, you know, one of the classic examples of this is in Hebrews 1, God having spoken in many ways and so on by the to the fathers, by the prophets, in these last days he has spoken to us in huio, which you have to translate in his son, but there's no autu, there's no article or anything. And typically commentators point out that the lack of the article here simply reveals a perspective of one who is by nature son. In other words, it is not son as the title, the son, but someone who is son. And again, there's a measure of truth in that. I don't think you ought to press it too much. There's a famous old popular writer, Newell. You ever heard of William Newell? How many real fundies do we have here? But he had great expositions, you know, popular expositions, and I have his little commentary on Hebrews, and he really waxes eloquent on this one, you know. And he says, you know, just as you read it, just read in son, and keep saying to yourself, in son, and then you'll grasp this wonderful truth. Well, I'm not sure that's quite the way to go. But, you know, people seem to have some kind of grammatical grounds for saying this is the character of divine and not that he is actually God. But that last inference is really quite a distortion of the grammatical point, to say nothing of the contextual features of what we have with here. Now let me mention four or five considerations that need to be taken into account here. First one is this. Nowhere else in the New Testament is the word theos used to mean divine. Especially not divine in the watered down sense that is being suggested. That's the first point. You don't have any real parallels to this kind of use. Second, there are plenty of passages, including several statements in this very passage, this very prologue, where you have theos without the article, definite article, and where no one would dispute that the reference is to the one true God. In verse 6, Egeneto anthropos, here came a man, sent paratheu, no article, and even your Jehovah's Witness, New World Translation, will have God with uppercase. Or verse 12, he gave them power to become technatheu, no article. Or verse 13, born ektheu, no article. Or even verse 18, or Romans 1, verse 1, or Romans verse 1, verse 17, etc., 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 etc. So you have a whole bunch of passages where no one disputes the reference is to God, capital G, without the definite article. So when, you know, a pair comes to your door and tells you, you know, you see there's no article, so it couldn't be, you know, God. Just be gentle in embarrassing them. Third point, if you really press the point about the lack of an article here, it really would lead you to the translation, a God. And the logos was a God. In other words, you would end up with polytheism. And polytheism, by the way, is not an inaccurate charge to throw at Arianism, as even Adolf von Harnack, in his History of Dogma, pointed out. Here's, you know, the epitome of modern liberalism, and he points out that the Arian position was fundamentally a polytheistic position. That's really what you end up with. A fourth consideration, which is the primary grammatical consideration, is that there is a very simple grammatical reason for omitting the article. As you all know very well, figuring out what is the subject and what is the object in a Greek sentence does not depend on the position of the word in the sentence, but on its case. Now, that means that for most sentences where you have a transitive verb and so on, it's very simple figuring out what is the subject and what is the object. But when you have a predicate clause, meaning that you have a subject, then a copula, a verb, or a linking verb like a me, now the predicate is going to be in the same case as the subject, nominative. And you have a problem. Because now, how in the world can you tell which is the subject and which is the predicate, since both nouns are in the nominative case? And there's a very simple rule. The greater definition, that is, the noun that is more greatly defined, is the subject. And the other one is the predicate. And one way, not the only way, probably the most common way to indicate which of the two nouns is the more defined noun, the more specific, if you will, is by using the article, which means that then you have to omit the article from the less defined noun, in this case, theos. It is not, incidentally, primarily a question of the position of theos. You know, there's one of those rules that people talk about. They try to explain this passage by saying, well, because theos comes before the verb, that's why it doesn't have the definite article. There may be something going on there, but there are too many exceptions to that particular rule. I don't think that's the main issue. The main issue is that you have to indicate which is the subject. And you do it by putting the definite article with logos, and then you don't need it. You don't want to put it with theos, because that is the predicate. And so you do translate, and the word was God. One final consideration, which I'm not too sure about this, but it may be worthwhile thinking about it. In addition to everything else we have looked at right here, there may be a theological reason for omitting the article, namely, to avoid Sabellianism. The Sabellian heresy, as you know, is that which looks at the Trinity in terms of an identity of persons. And one could argue, as I said, I wouldn't push this one, but one could argue that if you had the article here, then you could get into that problem of having already said he was with Ton Theon, and now you say how Logos was Ha Theos, there may be confusion of the persons by putting it that way. I'm not sure that's true, but it's something to keep in mind. And you see, from that perspective, then it would be proper to say that the absence of the article reflects some attention to Jesus' character. Remember the anarthrous noun calling attention to the character? That's okay to say that, but the character is divine in the true sense of divine. And you cannot be divine without being God. You see, so you can acknowledge the possibility that the anarthrous form calls attention to the character, somewhat in distinction from the identity of person, if you will. And that does not for one second suggest that you're dealing with someone who is less than God. That's not at all the point. Questions on verse 1. All right, let's move on to the third major part of the lecture, theology, the theology of the passage, which we have touched on in one way or another. But there are two or three things that I want to spend a little bit of time reflecting on. First one has to do with the meaning of logos. Why this term, logos? And I'm sure you're aware that an incredible amount of attention has been given to this. I think it's probably excessive, quite frankly. And excessive to the degree that it may have, it may distort people's perspective on the passage. Logos, as you know, was a term used quite consistently in the philosophical vocabulary. And it seems reasonable to think that in the mind of the original readers, there may have been some association because they would hear this term in philosophical contexts. Possibly so. However, the term logos also had wide non-technical uses. Wide non-technical uses. And you always have to be aware of the fact that, you know, any language at any point in time is going to have certain vocabulary items where one and the same term will be used in a broad popular sense and also used in a very specialized technical sense. And people handle that without any trouble whatsoever. Logos, widely used in the term in the sense of reason, but also speech and matter and the word more specifically. And if I remember correctly, the King James Version has, at least a dozen or 15 different translations for the word logos throughout the New Testament. It's a very common, widely used term, and I think we need to be careful not to assume that most people reading this would say, oh yeah, I was just, you know, reading Philo's discussion of logos this morning. I don't think that's quite the way it worked out. But perhaps, you see, this is part of the association that the author is banking on to try to get people to be thinking along various lines, maybe. One can also argue that particularly Jewish readers would have associated the term logos, for example, with the Aramaic term memrah, the memrah which appears so frequently in the Targums later. And, even though the Targums apparently, at least most of them, were not in written form at this point, there undoubtedly was a long-standing Targumic tradition. And when you pick up the Palestinian Targum, you know, at the very beginning of the Old Testament, you read Genesis 1, in the beginning, Memra Elohim, the Word of God, created the heavens and the earth. And time again, you have this Memra, depending upon your perspective here, is this some kind of attempt to avoid anthropomorphism or to distance God from the creation, or maybe it isn't quite that involved, but it's very common. And Memra means something like word in Aramaic. And given the allusions to Genesis 1, what is more likely for a Jew in particular, or even a Gentile familiar with the Septuagint, to think about? Plato's use of logos, or the memra associations that would have been common in the Jewish thought at the time? Or wisdom. The emphasis nowadays on the significance of the chokhmah, the sophia, which is, that too is being overdone to be sure, but people have pointed out lots of parallels, and it may be that once again, because of the associations between wisdom and law, the language here is intended to get us to think along the lines of wisdom in the Old Testament. But whatever associations may be linked to this term, and to whatever extent the author was thinking of them, the bottom line, in my way of thinking, is that John's main point is disarmingly simple. Here you have a very simple and obvious point being made. You have an explicit, I think, not everybody seems to agree, But I find that it is an explicit reference to creation when he says, en arche, I don't think it is possible for a Jew or even for a Gentile familiar with the Septuagint to read those words in arche and not think of Genesis 1:1 in the beginning. I don't think it's possible. So an explicit reference to creation leads us directly to think about the way God created the world through the word of his command. He spoke and it happened. And here's the Logos in the beginning, and then we're told that he created everything. How can you possibly miss it? Can't miss it. And then the parallelism between Logos in verse 1 and the verb exegesata, he showed him forth or explained him or whatever in verse 18, confirms that the idea of revelation is already present here in verse 1. So that from the start, John is telling you that he intends to present Jesus as God's revelation, because he is God's wisdom who was with him in the beginning. And as Proverbs tells you, I was there when God created the world. It was created, you know, through my agency. A second issue of great importance is the really the startling character of verse 17. Because the law was given through Moses, comma, grace and truth, egeneta, came through Jesus Christ. That is startling, I say. Particularly when we think that a Jewish audience would have automatically associated the law with wisdom. There's an article by Eldon Epp, which, as I recall, appeared in the Fesheret for George Ladd. I hope I'm right about that, in which he brought together a lot of these parallels, showing that a Jew reading the prologue would have certainly thought of this conception of wisdom, but a Jew could not have thought of wisdom in separation from the law. So you can appreciate the impact of reading a prologue which is getting the reader to be thinking along the lines of wisdom. And so a Jewish reader would have been thinking about law, you know. And then all of a sudden you come to verse 17 and you get this antithesis. Oh, the law was given by Moses, but. Now there's no but in the Greek, but there surely is an antithesis. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. That's what I mean by startling. It's not quite what you would expect to set such an antithesis between law and this revelation from God. Now, what do we do with it? I'm sure you realize that in classical dispensationalist thought, John 1:17 has been a key passage in support of some very sharp dichotomy between the older covenant and the dispensation of grace. And if you pick up a copy of the older Scofield Bible, it's very clear and you know, black and white, really. Seems to me that we also have to avoid going to the other extreme and water down the antithesis completely. So how to avoid watering down the antithesis on the one hand or absolutizing it on the other? Well, just read the rest of the Gospel of John, I think, because the body of the Gospel reflects really a twofold approach here, or a double perspective. On the one hand, Jesus can distance himself from the law. For example, when he's speaking to the Pharisees and he says things like, your law. He seems to be distancing himself from it, and you could take that kind of a passage as, okay, you have a radical antithesis between what I'm telling you and what you claim to be your law. But at the same time, in the Gospel, you have passages where Jesus identifies himself with the law. And the most striking, of course, is in chapter 5, if you believe Moses, you would believe me. If you believe Moses, you would believe me. Well, then obviously there's no antithesis of faith here. It is not reject Moses so that you can believe in me. It's that you're rejecting me because you're not believing Moses. So you find within the body of the Gospel itself this apparent tension, which I think you have to take back now to verse 17 and help you appreciate that you don't want to take that tension into one extreme or the other. Now, part of the resolution, but it isn't the whole resolution, and in fact, it would be too simple to appeal to the problem of the Jewish misuse of the law. For example, you know, Daniel Fuller is especially known in this regard, trying to, that I think really does water down the antithesis. And you argue that, the contrast here and elsewhere in Paul, for example, is not between the Gospel and the law. It's between the Gospel and a Jewish misunderstanding of the law. Well, I think that's too simple, if that's all you have to say about it. But I think it is a factor that cannot be totally left out of account. That as John is writing his Gospel, undoubtedly, he is speaking to not simply with reference to the law bare and simple, but to the law as it is functioning in the context of unbelieving Jewish society. And that surely has to color somewhat what lies behind the text. So I think a sensitivity to that factor, as well as to the redemptive historical discontinuities, genuine discontinuities, that are intrinsic to the biblical message. When you think of that, I think that's sufficient to explain verse 17. So that neither a dispensationalist approach, on the one hand, nor the thesis of Daniel Fuller is necessary. I think Carson has a pretty good discussion of this issue on pages 131 to 134. And one of his concluding comments is that verse 16, which begins with the haughty, is an explanation of verse 14. The meaning then would be something like this: we have seen his glory, that's verse 14, because from the fullness of his grace and truth, we have received grace that replaces the earlier grace. And so he takes the anti charitas of verse 16 at face value, not trying to water down the meaning of the anti. But Carson makes the point that this is not to be viewed as there was no grace before and now we have grace. Yes, there was grace before, but now there's a new stage that in a sense takes the place of that previous stage. The earlier grace is the grace of the antecedent but essentially promissory revelation. And I think Carson does justice both to the anti-charitas and to the antithesis of verse 17. while at the same time recognizing that fundamentally you have the continuity of God's progressive revelation of His grace. Now, mentioning the problem of continuity and discontinuity in the progress of redemptive history leads us to go back for a minute to verse 14, and this is the last thing that I want to talk about. Verse 14 is certainly the high point of the prologue, and the word, the Logos, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, glorious of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. If we pay close attention to verse 14, I think it's going to help us understand the antithesis of verse 17. Now, to appreciate verse 14, you've got to take fully into account its allusions to the book of Exodus, chapters 32 through 34, in a very subtle way. John does that for us already by the use of this term eskenosen. which many people have pointed out, and I think appropriately, that the sounds of these three consonants would certainly remind a Jew of the verb shachan, to dwell, and therefore the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory. The verb skenah itself would call to mind the tent where God's glory appeared in the wilderness. And, you know, for many of us, we might miss this, but it's impossible, again, to my way of thinking, to suggest that John is not intending to begin to raise certain kinds of expectations by the use of this terminology. But if you have any doubts about it, you just keep reading verse 14 in the light of Exodus 32 through 34, and you can't really avoid some conclusions. You remember the setting here. Moses has been up on the mountain and, you know, receiving the law. And then God tells him, you better go down because there's trouble. And Moses goes down and the people are, you know, made this golden calf, and it really is trouble. Then when you get to chapter 33, and God instructs Moses to leave the place and go. And Moses is a little bit down. Chapter 33, verse 12. Moses said to the Lord, now you've been telling me, lead these people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, I know you by name, and you have found favor with me. If I have found favor in your eyes, teach me your ways, so I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people. So obviously, Moses is asking for some kind of reassurance. I mean, this is getting a little discouraging here. And so the Lord replies, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. All right. And Moses said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. However, how will anyone know that you are pleased with us, with me and with your people, unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? again, as a kind of a diplomatic way of saying, give me something else here, give me something else. And the Lord said to Moses, I will do the very thing you have asked, because I am pleased with you and I know you by name. And then Moses gets very bold here and says, now show me your glory. And the Lord said, Yahweh said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, Yahweh, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Remember verse 18 of John 1, no one has ever seen God except somebody. Then Yahweh said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, glory, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. Chapter 34, the Lord said to Moses, chisel out two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Be ready in the morning and then come up on Mount Sinai. Present yourself to me there on the top of the mountain. No one is to come with you or be seen anywhere on the mountain. Not even the flocks and herds may graze in front of the mountain. So Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones and went up Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him. And he carried the two stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, Yahweh. In other words, it is very clear that the showing of his glory to Moses is inextricably tied to the pronouncing or the giving forth of the name, of the covenant name Yahweh. That's what's going on. Verse 6, and he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, Yahweh, Yahweh, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. Rav, Chesed, Va'emet. Abundant in Chesed, grace, mercy, emet, faithfulness, truth. I mean, how can you possibly not make the connections here? And even though it's true that the Septuagint doesn't, I guess has Elias here, but I mean, that's hardly sufficient reason not to see what is really going on. Of course, verse 14 is very likely an allusion to the Mount of Transfiguration. But that's only because we know the synoptics, and we know the synoptic tradition. But in a not so subtle way, I mean, you think about this is not subtle at all, really. John is telling us at the very beginning, in the very prologue, and by the way, that's another reason I tell you, if the Jehovah's Witness comes to you arguing about verse 1, just give him verse 1 and go to verse 14. John is telling us, as God, Yahweh, in the wilderness revealed his glory to Moses, how? By pronouncing his name and defining it in this way, Rav Chesed Va'emet, full of mercy or grace and faithfulness or truth. So now, the Logos, who was with God in the beginning and who was Theos, has become flesh, has taken up another tabernacle, another tent, and we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only begotten of the Father, Pleiades Caritas Kai Aletheos. And you see, this verse, you know, once and for all settles the question how John intended to present Jesus. And now you can also appreciate how, as you keep reading the narrative of the gospel, And you keep finding these references to, you know, just as God gave his thirsty people water and his hungry people bread, so here is Yahweh has come back to abide with his people. His glory is being revealed, and you keep getting that theme over and over throughout the gospel. And he is meeting the needs of his people in a way that the Old Testament narrative was only a shadow of. And so now we have charin anticharitas, a grace in place of that earlier grace, not supplanting it in the sense that that wasn't true or whatever, but appreciating the fullness and the greatness of the revelation. And that's why, you know, in the context of all of our Reformed convictions, we want to be very, 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 very careful not to emphasize the continuity between the covenants in such a way that we start forgetting the discontinuity. Discontinuity is a bad word in some respects. Not only is it too long, but it just gives the wrong idea. It's obviously not a rejection of, but a recognition that that was a preliminary stage, a promissory stage, and the fullness of the revelation has come now. And if you try to hold on to that earlier stage, you are in real trouble because you're not understanding what's going on. And that's why not only the Gospel of John, but, you know, Paul, when he writes to the Galatians, and the author of Hebrews, when he writes to the Hebrews, all these people, their problem was they had not read Voss, you know. They were not understanding the significance of this development in redemptive history and trying to hang on to an earlier stage that has indeed been, quote-unquote, replaced by the fullness of grace and truth that comes in the person of Jesus Christ. And so this whole theme of Jesus as the revelation of God's glory, you can see how indeed it covers the whole of the gospel and becomes the way in which the primary message that John is trying to convey gets developed. And you can also see, I hope, that to imagine that the prologue is independent of the gospel in terms of its historical origins, you know, that somebody just tacked it on at some point or whatever, just simply does not do justice to how closely tied are the thematic elements linking the prologue with the development in the narrative. Well, questions about either just verse 14 or the prologue more generally? You mean about in the predicate clause? All the grammars. The commentaries, oddly enough, usually don't address that point specifically, even yeah. though to my mind it's the most obvious one. But I think any standard grammar will, comment. One that for some reason comes to mind right now, I guess because I used to use it when I was at Westmont, but the elementary textbook that had been written by Getches. Know about Getches? It's a text called The Language of the New Testament. And for some reason, I happen to remember that he has a section where he talks about, again, the various degrees of definiteness. Sometimes if it's a proper noun, then that's the more definite one, so it must be the subject. If it has a definite article, that's the more definite one, must be the subject. And there are two or three other categories. But I think any grammar, at least to some degree, must have something to say about that. Well, I mean, I definitely do not recommend that you deal with the punctuation of the Greek, from the pulpit. I think the very richness of the passage, that's why it's so difficult to answer this question, because there must be a thousand ways, really, to either pick up on a subject or pick up on interrelated themes, and so just depending, because since you cannot do justice to everything that's here in any one sermon, you have any number of ways in which you can, if you will, synthesize the material by being very selective. I mean, I personally, and this is maybe as much a matter of style as a question of what is right or better, you know, but I personally like to take chunks. You know, I don't like to take one verse or two, even though you could, you know, preach a whole series in one verse or two. I think it all in all, may be more helpful to take the whole chunk and then be selective. Two or three things that you think are prominent in the passage, you really press those home. But in the course of doing that, you can make allusion to the other things that you don't really have time to develop, but it helps people make connections, so that when they go back to read the passage, it isn't just one verse and some wonderful things connected to it, but they can make sense of the passage as a whole. But this is one where it really is difficult to do that and keep your sermon under an hour and a half or whatever. It's a curious thing because, you must have noticed that, yeah, he spends a lot of time on Philo, the Hermetic literature, in the first part of the book. But when he actually comes to the second part of the book and he goes through the narrative, hardly says anything, you know, about Philo. He does make lots of references to the Old Testament material. And that is interesting. You know, maybe you ought to write a doctoral dissertation on Dodd's... it is valuable in the sense that anything that helps you build, you know, that broad base of the culture as a whole gives you a broader perspective, so that you can take the passage and do justice to it in its whole social setting. But it is true that when you ask the question more specifically, you know, what exegetical payoff do I get directly? Yeah, I don't think Philo is all that helpful. By the way, for the exam, I will probably have two questions. One question will be asking just to summarize all your great exegetical research on the passage that you have chosen, and I'll ask the question in some, you know, general way that you can basically do whatever you want to. And the other question also will give you some flexibility. You know, I could ask you something about, you know, what do you think now about the structure of the gospel? something, again, general enough that you can try to impress me with the stuff that you know well. I'm not going to ask you for something specific about a particular passage necessarily, but I do want you in your answer to give me specifics. You know, you have some flexibility as to what specifics you use, but try to be as concrete as possible in defending, you know, your answer. So just think of it as a fun day at Van Til Hall or something. Greek Testaments and Hebrew Bibles and Septuagint is also allowed.